The information in this podcast is provided for education and research information only. It is not a substitute for professional health advice.
If you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, and you feel a little bit overwhelmed by all you need to know, then this is the right podcast for you. Welcome to the show. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney, and this is The Kick, your expert-led podcast that delivers the essentials of growing a baby. Make sure you head to our website, growmybaby.com.au, to get some awesome free tools like our Pregnancy Knowledge Checker to help you feel like you got this.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney.
And Pat sounds a bit different today, doesn't he?
I'm phoning it in.
You are phoning it in.
Yeah, I'm phoning it in, literally. I'm down here in Colac operating today. Once a month I drive down to this lovely place and do some gynae surgery for them. And I'm phoning this podcast in after a long day in theatre.
Yeah, we really thought that Pat would be finished by about four today, but that was not the case, and now it's nearly six. So our guest has been very patient. So let's get on to who we are going to interview today, Pat. Today we're interviewing Hayley Trengrove. Now, Hayley has been very generous and put up her hand and said, yes, I will come on to your podcast as someone that's done the Grow My Baby program. So Hayley is originally from Christchurch, New Zealand. She moved to Melbourne in 2012 and never left. When she's not busy running her own small business editing wedding photos, she is raising a beautiful boy called Isaiah alongside her partner, Henok. Hayley was first diagnosed with endo when she was 18 and has had multiple surgeries to remove it. Since then, she's also experienced ectopic pregnancies, a natural pregnancy, gestational diabetes, multiple rounds of IVF and miscarriage, and she is currently pregnant with her fifth pregnancy. So, Hayley, welcome to the Kick Pregnancy Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start, Hayley, with maybe telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, sure. So I was first diagnosed with endometriosis when I was about 18. Interestingly enough, I didn't have like the classic symptoms. So for quite a long time, I felt like we were specking our heads against a wall, not really knowing what was going on. But eventually we did find a specialist who was pretty sure it was going to be endometriosis. We ended up going ahead with the surgery, and I had stage 3 out of 4. This was such a long time ago. I don't know if they still grade it or stage it. And I also had a cyst about the size of a tennis ball as well. So that got all cleared up, and I was pretty good for about 6 years or so. It was always sort of in the back of my mind that it's something that can reoccur. I decided to go, I think I must have been about 25-ish, to just go and investigate it again. Some of the symptoms were coming back even earlier, but I just kept putting it off. I decided to go back and get another. I was in Australia by this time, in Melbourne. So I got another opinion, and we decided to go ahead with surgery. And it was back, but not to the same level.
Yeah, wow. And so at 25, you mainly were seeking support because of the pain, or were you already thinking about becoming pregnant at that stage?
I wasn't in a situation where I was able to. I hadn't met a partner or anything like that, so I wasn't in a situation to get pregnant. That was always in the back of my mind of like whether endometriosis would play with it, interfere with like getting pregnant in the future. But I just wanted to keep on top of it, and of course try and get rid of these symptoms and the pain that I was having to try and reduce that.
And Pat, can you add? Do we still talk about endometriosis in different stages, stage 3 and stage 4?
Yeah, I think we definitely do. There are a number of scoring systems, and the one that was in most common use at the time was the American Fertility Society, or AFS scoring system, which is, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's just that I sometimes worry a little bit about these scoring systems when it necessarily sort of suggests that if someone's got grade 3 endometriosis by that system, that their disease is somehow more troublesome than someone with grade 2 endometriosis. But it doesn't really work that way. It's mostly an anatomical description of where the endometriosis deposits are. But as we know, that doesn't necessarily tell us much about how much pain or trouble or even infertility that person might be having. And theoretically, someone with stage 1 disease could have more pain and be more affected than someone with asymptomatic stage 4 disease.
What is stage 4, just to, you know, finish that point, what does stage 4 actually mean? Is it how deep the endo's gone, or how does that get classified?
Yeah, how deep it's gone, and also whether there's ovarian endometriomas, which are those big blobs of endometriosis within the ovaries. And then lastly, how much the bladder and bowel are involved, and in particular if there's something called an obliterated pouch of Douglas, which means that the endometriosis has caused the last bit of the bowel to get stuck to the back of the uterus, eliminating that natural space that there should be between the uterus and the bowel.
Does any of that ring a bell, Hayley?
It does. I never got told to that description. But my bowel's always been the thing that's been affected the most. Mm. And then there's another word which Pat will have to step in here, but like, and it starts with A.
Adenomyosis?
Yes, that's the one. And that's in the muscle, is that right? And you can't do anything about that.
Yeah, not really. So adenomyosis is where the painful tissue is not out of the uterus like it is in endometriosis, where we can go in and cut it out, but it's in the wall of the uterus itself, and it typically causes painful periods and pelvic pain and pain with intercourse, very much overlapping with the features of endometriosis. Normally, most commonly, endometriosis has a peak incidence in the 20s, and adenomyosis is more commonly seen in that group of women who are more 40+, and those are just averages, and we are seeing plenty of young women who need to keep their fertility, who've been diagnosed with adenomyosis as well as endometriosis.
And I could imagine, like, the whole time, Hayley, that all of this is in your mind when you're starting to, I don't know, meet your partner, think about babies. So maybe could you tell us about what that decision to become a parent looked like for you?
Yeah, sure. I guess I always knew that I was going to be a mum. I didn't really know what that would look like and how the journey would go. Obviously, I knew that I had the history of endo, so maybe there would be some challenges. But of course, there's always people that have endo and go on to have natural pregnancies and are completely fine. I did get a bit of a kick up the bum, I would say, from a couple of specialists over the years saying, you need to get on to this, you know, as I was edging closer to 30. But I also wanted to meet the right person and make sure that I was raising children with the person that I wanted to be with and everything.
That is probably the most common thing, Pat, isn't it? Like, you know, yes, somebody should get on with their fertility journey if that's what they're choosing to do. But, you know, sometimes you've got to be ready and find the right person to do that with.
It's such an interesting point because it's always a little bit difficult to know as somebody's endometriosis surgeon, exactly how far you're supposed to take that discussion. And we've got to be careful with the feelings of our patient that we don't overstep. But if we do start saying, look, you've got bad endometriosis and this is going to affect your fertility, then all those things are true. And, if the relationship with the patient has progressed to the point where we can comfortably discuss these things, then we start to talk about options, like egg freezing. And, you know, these conversations will often flow into another. If we've got someone who's got significant issues, perhaps they're 30+, and bad endometriosis, then we might seriously start discussing what else we can do to help.
Yeah. Plus the other option, and that is what the new Wiggle has done, and she's chosen, I don't know about whether it's endometriosis that she's got, but she's chosen to be a single mum and go through IVF, and we're seeing more of that in the clinic too, Pat, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely we are, and that, of course, is another option open to people. It very much depends on the individual and what they've planned for the future and how long they feel that they can really wait for a baby and so forth.
Apart from the endo and apart from thinking about, well, can I even get pregnant, did you have any other fears going into pregnancy?
Honestly, no. That was my main one that was sort of in the back of my head. I was always pretty positive because it was a gut feeling that I was going to be a mum. So I knew it would happen. I just didn't really know how it was going to happen or what kind of journey I would go through to get there.
And it might be great for you to tell the listeners a little bit about how you came about hearing about us and what made you want to join the Grow My Baby program. Were you already into trying for a baby, or were you already pregnant?
No, I don't believe I was pregnant at the time. I think we were trying, and it was just when COVID hit. So I was out doing a lot of walks and listening to podcasts, and I just happened to come across yours, and I got a little bit addicted to it. There was just so much great information, and it was so simple and never felt overwhelming, because it obviously is when you start to go down, you know, getting pregnant and all that kind of stuff. There is so much information out there. And I think when you are able to zoom in on one group or people like yourselves, it takes a lot of the noise out and becomes less overwhelming. And I think I was, well, yeah, one of the ones, the first ones that jumped on your program, because it was so fresh. And it was great because I was able to go through the course at my own pace. And yeah, everything was just so detailed. I like to be prepared. So for anyone that likes to be prepared and go in confident and calmly to each appointment and just know what's coming up, yeah, I highly recommend it. Just for the fact that there's so much information, and it's broken down in bite-sized pieces, and it's easy to follow.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. That's really great. So you joined the program, and how much longer before you became pregnant?
I think it was only about a month or two.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
And what happened with that pregnancy?
That pregnancy, I got to 6 weeks. Obviously, I found out at 4 weeks when I had missed my period that I was pregnant. I remember I was out on a walk and I just felt this pain on my left side. And I went, uh-oh, I've heard about this in your podcasts. But I just put it to the back of my mind and I was ignoring it a little bit. I went home. I took some Panadol. It wasn't too bad, but it was uncomfortable. My partner at the time said, why don't you go to emergency? And I said, oh, I just don't want to be one of those people that blocks up the system. So I went to bed, and then I woke up at 3 o'clock, and it was, I was in a lot of pain. And I said, look, I'm going to be one of those people. So we went to emergency, and yeah, unfortunately, because of COVID, I had to go through the whole emergency and everything by myself, which was very unfortunate. At the start, they didn't really know what was happening because it was so early on in the pregnancy and everything like that. And then I had a scan. They had to have multiple people come and look at the scan, because they were obviously trying to find the pregnancy in the uterus and everything. And then they said, okay, it's an ectopic. So I got transferred to another hospital. And that night I had the tube removed. I was actually starting to bleed internally with that one too, which was a bit scary. So yeah, so then I lost that tube, and obviously I lost that pregnancy. So that was the first pregnancy.
Mm. Pat, is 6 weeks about the peak time for an ectopic to present?
Yeah, usually a little bit later. So a lot of people have a scan in early pregnancy just to go along and make sure everything's okay and see that fetal heartbeat. And occasionally we'll do that scan and find that the uterus looks empty, and yet they've got plenty of hormone level or an increasing level of hormone level, so there's pregnancy somewhere. And that's when we think, well, if it's not in the uterus and it should be by now, then it's probably somewhere out in the tubes, and the ultrasound people will go out looking in the tubes and find the ectopic there before it's ruptured. So a lot of people getting an ectopic pregnancy treated without it causing any pain and or bleeding, and it hasn't ruptured yet. If that's not diagnosed in that way, then later on, you know, a week or so later, it'll burst out the tube, and the blood will spray out on the woman's insides from around the pregnancy, and that causes pain. Mm. And then that's the sort of situation we turn up to the hospital emergency department with lots of pain, obvious blood in the pelvis on ultrasound, maybe low blood pressure, and need an emergency operation.
Mm. All in all, it sounds like that would have been a really distressing time. How long were you advised to wait before you could start trying again?
You're listening to The Kick,
with Dr. Pat and Bridget.
Hi, everyone. Well, we've got a milestone coming up and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners. May 7th, we're going to launch our 100th episode of The Kick. And guess what? We couldn't have done it without our listeners. To celebrate, we are asking for you to tell us your biggest tips about getting pregnant, being pregnant, becoming a mother, birth, anything that you think future listeners might benefit from. And we want 100 voices. As a gift to you for adding your voice, we will give everyone a whopping 50% discount to any of our programs. You can use this yourself or gift it to a friend. To add your voice, go to our website, growmybaby.com.au. We will then put a selection of the voices together for our 100th episode. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So the website again is growmybaby.com.au. We are so excited to hear all your biggest tips for future mamas just like you.
From memory, it was until my next period, so it was actually quite soon. I remember being scared about the fact that if I lost one tube, does that mean I've only got like a 50% chance of becoming pregnant again? Which they explained that it's not true. And obviously, and Dr. Pat can speak to that, because I think that would be a lot of fear of people thinking they've just reduced their chances down to 50%.
Yeah, that's a really common fear that people have. And logically, you'd think, oh, well, I've got half as many tubes as I used to, so I'm kind of half as fertile. But obviously, it doesn't really work that way. The paired organs within our body often work pretty well if there's just one. And if you lose one tube, the fertility is not reduced by nearly as much as 50%, and it might be as little as about 5%. And basically, you can ovulate on either side and still catch the egg down the remaining tube.
And I know that you always use that analogy of, like, if you've got one eye, you're not totally blind.
Yeah, that's right. So you look at an organ as important as our eyes, and if you've only got one, you can still see okay. Yeah, so the tubes are similar. You go pretty well with one.
Yeah. And for you, Hayley, you went on to have a pregnancy.
Yeah, so I decided to give my body 3 months to just heal for physically and mentally. And then we tried for another 3 months, like actively trying. And then, yes, we got pregnant, which was amazing. And obviously, as it's ended, we've ended up with our son, Isaiah, which is amazing and very, very grateful for it now. Even more so with what comes after that.
I know. And, you know, I don't want to brush over it, but you did get gestational diabetes at 16 weeks with Isaiah. Yeah,
I did. I was only 1 point over. I think the cutoff is 5, and I was 5.1, unfortunately. So I went a couple of weeks without insulin, and then I had to have a lunchtime insulin and then eventually a dinnertime insulin as well. So that was a lot to deal with on its own, really. I had a blood sugar test about the previous year, and I remember it was slightly high. So my GP decided, like, oh, you know, you might be fine, but let's just run it early just in case.
Yeah, well, that's good that they did, because we normally wouldn't test someone, perfectly healthy person, for pregnancy diabetes until they were 28 weeks. But they've picked up something subtle in your medical history there that suggested that you might have been more prone than average, in which case they've done a test early and found that diagnosis early, which is terrific.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
And so we got Isaiah, who is just adorable. He is honestly the most adorable little boy. He's now 2.
Thank you.
And you've supplied us with a photo, so we're going to put that on our Insta because, oh, my God. No wonder you want more of those. Yeah. Yeah, he's gorgeous. And so you have tried after having Isaiah, haven't you, for another baby?
Yeah, so we tried. We weren't actively trying, but at the same time, I wasn't worried if I had them close together or anything like that. It was just before Isaiah turned 1, I got pregnant, and we got to about 6 weeks again, and my doctor was like, oh, let's just take you for an early scan just to make sure that, you know, it's not another ectopic and we can just rule it out. And yeah, so we went for that scan, and the sonographer said, look, I'm really sorry, it's another ectopic. That was a blow. So I had to go straight to emergency again. Luckily, it wasn't COVID this time, so I had a bit of support at least. But yeah, it was pretty hard when the doctor came and said, look, you need to sign this form that's basically going to say we're taking you're never going to get naturally pregnant ever again. Sign away here kind of thing. So yeah, that ended up, so I lost that tube as well. Obviously I was thinking, okay, we're going to have to go down the IVF route now. Grateful that we still have options, but something I hadn't actually sort of thought was going to happen to me.
And Hayley, I think you told me that it was also shown that there was endo in that tube.
Yeah, so we actually sent that tube away for testing, just for clarity of why I was getting these ectopics. And yes, I came back saying that there was endo in the tube. So I guess that was kind of nice to at least get some information as to why it had happened. I mean, we had kind of guessed it was that. But yeah, to find out officially that that's what it was, that's what had caused it, sort of helped. It helps when you get answers to things, I guess.
Yeah. Pat, is endo in the fallopian tubes just impossible to remove?
It's very hard to remove. So endo actually being on the tube is one of the ways that endo can cause infertility. It's not really the most common or important way, but certainly it's one of the ways. And bad endometriosis will distort the anatomy within the pelvis, and it can block the tubes, literally physically block them. And surgically, the tubes are quite fragile, and it's very difficult to remove endometriosis from the tube itself without damaging the tube. If there's endometriosis in the wall of the tube, it might sometimes be just left there, rather than try and cut it all out and unintentionally damage the tube itself. We would then sort of identify that woman as someone who's at high risk of an ectopic. So they've got pregnant, but they're known to have abnormal tubes, and so therefore more likely that the pregnancy will be stuck in the tube. And we'd set that person up for an early ultrasound around that 6-week mark, so that if there was an ectopic pregnancy, we could pick it up and treat it before it ruptured. And really, that's what happened in the second of your ectopics, which is a very difficult and very sad situation.
And would a tube flushing do anything? Did you have one of those, Hayley?
Yes, I did have one. After my first ectopic, I did flush the tube. I've always wondered if that's what's helped us get Isaiah, or whether it was just a little miracle that got through. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we call it flushing the tubes, but it's really more of a diagnostic test to show that the tube is open. That doesn't really tell you whether there's endometriosis on it or not. It just tells you that the blue dye can fit through the tube. You can have that done at the time of a laparoscopy as an add-on to a laparoscopy, or it can be done as an outpatient test through an ultrasound service. It's more to show whether the tube is open or not. Occasionally, tubes will become blocked with just mucus, and it's thought that the actual test to see whether the tube is open might actually blast some mucus out of the tube and open it up again if it was previously blocked. And that might explain that little uptick in fertility that's seen in the first couple of months after a laparoscopy, because if we've established that the tubes are open, we might have actually kind of unblocked them as well.
And just so our listeners, if they're hearing the medical term, what is it again? Because I've actually forgotten what it's called.
Yeah, when it's done at the time of a laparoscopy, that's called tubal dye studies. And when it's done as a test in a radiology practice, it's called a hysterosalpingogram.
There we go. No wonder I couldn't remember it.
It gives a picture of the uterus and tubes using either dye or this stuff that's called like soda water, like it's got little bubbles in it. And when you put that water up into the uterus, you can see the little bubbles making their way down the tube on ultrasound. And you can see the shape of the internal cavity and whether or not those bubbles are making their way down the tubes.
So, Hayley, then you had to go on to IVF. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, sure. So we did our first round of IVF in July last year. I had been taking some prenatals and everything for months, trying to get as healthy as possible leading up to it. We ended up collecting 9 eggs, but we only managed to get one embryo out of it. So it felt like quite a lot of pressure on that little embryo. We went with a fresh transfer and we got pregnant. And I thought, oh, how good is this? Like, people have got to go do rounds and rounds of IVF. How lucky are we? And we had a scan at 6 weeks and there was a heartbeat. It was sitting in the, obviously sitting in the uterus. There was nowhere else for it to go at that point. And I had like nausea and tiredness to a mild level looking back to it. And then we went to do our 12-week scan and our NIPT blood test. And I remember the sonographer was just doing the external on the tummy scan and she goes, oh, just going to have to do an internal. And I just, my heart dropped and I just went, should be able to see it by this point, you know. So I did an internal and she said, look, I'm so sorry. Like, there's no heartbeat. It looks like it stopped growing around 7 to 8 weeks, which was a shock just because I still had nausea, obviously because of those, the pregnancy hormone was still in my system and probably still dropping. But I didn't have any bleeding, so I didn't have any signs of miscarriage. So I think it was, yeah, quite a shock when we had that scan.
And then did you have to go on to have an operation for that?
Yes, I did. So about 3 or 4 days later, I went back to my specialist and the same specialist did the surgery.
God, what a run you've had.
A hectic few years, yeah.
And so did you then go on and go back to IVF or what happened for you next?
So that was in August. In October, I went back to my specialist who had done the previous endo operation about 7 years ago. And I said to her, look, I'm trying to get, obviously IVF's very expensive. It's emotionally, physically draining. And I said, look, I need to get all my ducks in a row before we go ahead and do another round. I said, I'm worried that endometriosis is on my ovaries or playing a part in any of this because the egg collection was quite low for my age and she was quite surprised. She thought it might be around more about the 16 egg mark. Obviously, everybody's different. She said, oh, look, you know, on your last two ectopic surgeries, nobody's mentioned anything about seeing any endo. And I said, yeah, that's like fine and I respect that. But at the same time, they're not going and looking for endo. And it's been 7 years since I've had the operation. So I still think it would be a good thing to go ahead and just double check. And so she said, yeah, no, okay, let's do it. So we did that in October and there was endo on one of my ovaries, which can, I believe, affect quality and possibly quantity. I'm not sure. Dr. Pat, do you know?
Yeah, it can affect a number of things, the quality and the quantity and the safety of the egg pickup. You know, to collect the eggs in an IVF situation, we put an ultrasound up into the vagina and pass a little needle up through the wall of the vagina and suck the eggs out of the ovaries, multiple eggs out of the ovaries. And if there's endometriosis in that ovary at the time, then it can lead to a high risk of infection. So that was worth discovering and definitely worth treating. And you've also highlighted a common problem, which is that it can be quite a dilemma, really, in someone who has a choice at a certain point between having further laparoscopic surgery for known endometriosis versus just having another IVF cycle if they've got some stored, frozen, high-quality embryos. And, you know, the IVF guys have done quite a lot of work on this and sort of made a bit of an algorithm to help people decide what their best option is. One of the things that you had against you at that time is that you didn't have any frozen embryos. If you did have high-quality frozen embryos at that time, they might have gone ahead and used one of those rather than do more surgery. But it sounds like you really advocated for yourself in that discussion very effectively and went for the laparoscopic surgery, which was well worth doing.
Yeah, so we after that, which was October, and then in December we did another round, the second round of IVF. It was slightly different to the first round medication-wise. But again, we ended up with 9 eggs, but this time we got 3 embryos. So to me, that spoke volumes about doing the surgery before doing another round of IVF.
Wow. And then what happened? Did you have one of those embryos done as a fresh transplant or did you freeze or what did you do there?
Yeah, so we ended up transferring one as a fresh transfer and we froze the remaining 2.
Yeah.
So it was kind of nice to release that pressure of the fact that we only had one to work with like last time. And I'm pleased to say that I'm now 14 weeks pregnant.
That's so exciting.
Very exciting. Had a number of scans. I'm not going to lie. It doesn't clear your anxiety after going through all of that. Yeah, the scans definitely provide a lot of peace of mind. And I've got a lot worse morning sickness symptoms this time, which made me realize there's sort of the red flags that were potentially there from the last pregnancy.
Did you have any trouble getting your team to do more scans, or did they sort of say, no, we know your history, you can have as many scans as you want just for peace of mind?
Yeah, no, they were really good. They just said, look, yeah, exactly that. Come in whenever you need one, whenever you want one. It was at one point there was about a 4-week wait. I think it was like 8 weeks until between it was an 8-week scan and then it was the, you know, the 13-week scan. And I got to about 10 weeks and I went, no, I can't do this anymore. It's the anxiety going my head in. So I booked another one then there.
And at 14 weeks, have you started to feel any fetal movements yet?
I actually have. I felt them even earlier, probably about 12 weeks, which I know is crazy early. I have heard that that's quite common with a second pregnancy.
I don't know if there's any good evidence to back that up. You know, individual people will sometimes say that, yeah, I felt the movements much earlier in my second pregnancy compared to my first, or the other way around. But I'm not sure that it's actually true that we feel the movements earlier in subsequent pregnancies. It might be.
I can concur a little bit, though. For me, I did feel all of my pregnancies quite early on, except for the last. But I just think that was because he didn't move much. He still doesn't. but yeah, I think definitely there was the 12 weeks I was starting to feel just little flutters. And that can be reassuring too, Hayley, can't it?
Absolutely. I am grateful for that because, you know, I check in every now. I do have to be pretty still lying down and pretty in tune with my body to feel them at this point. But no, I can feel little kicks every now and then, which again, yeah, just like a little flutter. And I'm like, okay, we're still good. We're still there.
Yeah. So Hayley, you've had such a big time becoming a parent and we've discussed lots of issues today, but I just wondered whether you can pinpoint what the greatest challenge of growing a baby for you has been.
I would say the greatest challenge is that nothing can prepare you for loss and prepare your partner for going through loss as well. I mean, yeah, like there's been so many aspects. It is a huge journey. I guess just, again, in my gut, I knew I was going to be a mum and a mum of at least two children. And I think that's what kept me going. Yeah, it's challenging for sure. But I think if it's something that your heart truly desires, you can make it happen.
Yeah, I love your resilience and your persistence. Honestly, that just shines through, doesn't it, Pat?
You've heard me say this so many times. That is what impresses me so much about the women we look after. It's resilience and their strength and their ability miraculously to pick themselves up and try again in what can be a tough, tough game.
Absolutely.
Now, bad endometriosis, two ectopic pregnancies, pregnancy losses, and yet again and again and again, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off and you try again. It is very impressive.
So, Hayley, for anyone thinking about joining our programs, what words of encouragement would you give them to help them decide?
I think if you're someone who likes to be really prepared and know what's coming up and feel quite educated, because I know that there's so much noise out there, definitely worth jumping on board. Like I said earlier, everything is done at your own pace in bite-sized pieces. It's clear. It's easy to understand. Yeah, I can't recommend it highly enough.
So we're going to end all these story podcasts with the same question. So can I ask you, what do you know now that you wish you knew when you first started on this journey to become a parent?
That you will make it and it will work out. You've just got to keep going.
That's the theme of your this whole podcast. Like we said, you know, it's brilliant. Resilience and persistence.
Yeah, it pays off.
Hayley, we're looking forward to seeing pictures of your baby in September, please.
For sure, I'll send them through.
Yeah, good. And we wish you all the luck in the world and we thank you so much for giving up your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Hayley.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, wasn't that great, Pat?
Yeah, I think when we developed our podcast and our Grow My Baby program, there's a lot of information in there, and I don't think we imagined that one person would have like all of the things that we talk about happened to them.
I know, poor thing.
But yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad that she found use in all the things that we had available to her.
Well, we'll wrap it up there. But everybody, thank you so much. We'll see you next week, and have a great week. And bye for now.